Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
I'd like to welcome you to our presentation, ISO 9001:2015, Knowing What to Expect to Ensure a Stress-Free Audit. My name is Joseph Krolikowski, and I am the QMS Program Manager for Perry Johnson Registrars. Couple of notes for everyone. All of our participants today are on mute, but we absolutely want to address your questions, so please utilize the question portion of the dashboard. We will address questions at the end of the presentation. One of the more common questions that we get is whether or not the presentation will be made available after we're finished. Now, the answer to that is yes. We do make our presentations available in two key ways. First of all, if you want to get your hands on the slides, those can be downloaded from our website. Those will be made available shortly after we're finished. And if you'd like to rewatch this webinar with the live voiceover, you can do so on our YouTube page. And we have a link for that that can be accessed on our website as well. Just look for the heading Previously Recorded Webinars. Our topics for today, we're going to have just a couple of opening comments on ISO 9001 and what it's all about. We're going to explain how this presentation was pulled together, the methodology that was used. We're going to explore five key areas where the issues seem to be the most prevalent over the history of the standard. We'll have some discussion on a couple of other key areas, a special exploration of our expectations as they relate to leadership in the context of the audit. Just a few concluding remarks and then your questions. Now, for the whole of our presentation today, and really for any interactions that you're ever going to have with auditors, it's important to recognize that ISO 9001:2015 is an interpretive document. When it was first published, it was actually the first version of ISO 9001 to have an explanatory appendix included. This is Appendix A, of course. There's eight subsections therein that give some guidance on understanding certain things. It has since become one of the only ISO published standards to have a separate supplemental standard for explanatory purposes. And that is ISO 9002:2016. This is the Quality Management Systems Guidelines for the Application of ISO 9001:2015. Now, this document was published a little over a year after the ISO 9001 standard was written, and it is officially sanctioned guidance, and it gives you clause by clause ideas on fulfilling the requirements. It's not auditable, of course. It's not something that you can get certified to. And it's meant to help the users, the folks that are implementing ISO 9001, not necessarily the auditors or certification bodies. If there's anybody on our presentation today that remembers the 2000 version of the 9004 document, this is very similar in style and content to that publication. So, because ISO 9001:2015 is an interpretive document, it's important to acknowledge that none of these requirements has a perfect method for implementation. And the intention is that each of the organizations that tries to implement ISO 9001 is going to figure out what works best for them and for their team. And what the auditor is assigned to do is to review your methodology or review what you've done and exercise their best judgment as to whether or not what you've done truly fulfills the requirement in question. Now, one of the more interesting changes that we saw in the 2015 revision of ISO 9001 was that it eliminated the last of the required procedures. Now, if you go all the way back to the 1987 version of ISO 9001, at that time there were 16 required procedures for various areas. When we had the update in the year 2000, that list was trimmed down to six. There were six required procedures. Now, with the 2015 revision, there are no required procedures. So it is conceivable that an organization could conceive of a quality management system that is controlled without procedures. And obviously, that's fine. Now, having said that, if an organization chooses to have a procedure or a work instruction, for any activity, you have to understand that the content of that procedure can be cited in the context of an audit. And that's actually due to how we define the term audit criteria. An audit criteria is explained as follows. It's a set of policies, procedures, or requirements used as reference against which objective evidence is compared. So in other words, if you have things that you have self-imposed that go above and beyond what's written into ISO 9001, you can be held accountable to those things in the context of an audit. Now, ISO 9001 2015 is in its fifth year of publication, and the ISO 9001 standard itself has been around for over 30 years now. But in spite of that long tenure, it's interesting to note that many of the same things keep getting written up in ISO 9001 audits year after year. If you go back to 2000 to 1990, to any point between the past and now, it's the same issues that keep coming up. So what Perry Johnson Registrars did back in October 2018, we did a data mining exercise, and we used approximately 350 audits from a period of time roughly covering the prior 12 months. And we looked to see, okay, when nonconformances are written, where are they being written? What are the areas that are being cited? And the top five areas that came out of our analysis were as follows. The number one item cited was management review. The number two item cited internal audit. Quality objectives was three. Items pertaining to measurement devices was four. And things related to external provider approvals was number five. Now, it's interesting to note that three of these, management review, internal audit, and measurement device controls, these are all legacy requirements. These are things that have been included in the ISO 9001 standard going all the way back to revision one. So these are not new requirements. So recognizing that PJR cannot advocate specific methodologies to implement a requirement from ISO 9001 2015 or any other standard for that matter, what we figured we could do is try to provide some clarity on what these requirements are commonly interpreted to mean and how they are commonly fulfilled, to try to take the edge off, so to speak, in terms of what to expect in terms of auditor expectations. So over the next several slides, we're going to be going over our interpretations here and our trying to provide points of clarity. Now, please understand, this is not an official PJR endorsement of an approach, and it cannot be used as justification in a official nonconformance. Now, if you are in a position where you feel you have a nonconformance that is unwarranted, We are going to be providing some details a little bit later in the presentation for how you can dispute that nonconformance. So let's begin with management review. As I mentioned, this was the most cited item in terms of nonconformance in our data sampling pool. Now, the management review requirement is broken down into three subsections. And the first one talks about management needing to plan, or excuse me, review the organization's system at planned intervals to ensure suitability, adequacy, effectiveness, etc. Now, the key piece here is planned intervals. Our expectation is that you're going to have some manner of controlling both the frequency and the content of your management review meetings. Now, understand that what those controls are going to be are totally at your discretion. This could be internal schedules, it could be statements within procedures, it could be automated reminders on ERP systems. All of the above are considered acceptable in terms of showing that your intervals for management review are planned. Now, the second part of the requirement is a little bit more wordy. It says that the management review needs to be planned and carried out, taking into consideration, and then there's a long list of items that it is required that you include in the management review process. Things from prior management reviews, customer satisfaction information, process performance information, the results of audits, the adequacy of your resources, things related to risk actions, and opportunities for improvement. Now, each of the content items is mandatory, but it's not mandatory that every item be discussed at every management review. So if you want to kind of parse things out and have a couple of topics at a time and cover everything over a period of time, that's certainly fine. We have a lot of our clients that like to use PowerPoint presentations to capture the information that they're going to be discussing. That's fine. Not mandatory, but that's absolutely fine. A lot of our clients like to use a standardized agenda format to make sure that they don't forget anything. That's also perfectly fine, but also not mandatory. The last part of the management review requirement states that the outputs of the management review need to include decisions and actions. And that's another key focal point. This whole idea that the management review meeting has to be productive. It has to lead to decisions and actions and conclusions. This is not just a churn of information for information's sake. And then the last statement is that the organization shall retain documented information. Now, anytime you see that phrase, retain documented information, that is a record requirement. So you are required to keep records that show you've had these management reviews and documenting what were the decisions, what were the actions, and so forth. This is very often the first thing that the auditor is going to ask to see within the context of the audit is going to be the minutes of the most recent management review meeting. Let's move on and we'll tackle the internal audit requirement. This was the second most cited item in our data study. Now, the internal audit clause is broken up into a couple of pieces here. The first piece indicates that internal audits need to be conducted at planned intervals, there's that phraseology again, to provide information on whether the quality management system conforms, and that's been highlighted, and I'll tell you why in just a second, to the organization's own requirements for its quality management system, as well as the requirements of the international standard. And if the quality management system has been effectively implemented and maintained. So let's pick this first part a little bit apart here. Again, we note the wording planned intervals. And again, the scheduling mechanism is at your discretion, whether that's calendar triggers or audit plans or database scheduling or some combination therein. You need to be prepared to show how you have planned the internal audit activities. Again, you're absolutely permitted to do the internal audit in smaller portions. If you have 10 processes and you tell yourself you're going to do two processes every month, that's fine. If you're going to do the whole thing all at once, that's also fine. Also, the fact that the internal audit is done against the requirements of this international standard, this implies that the organization is expected to make sure that all of the requirements from ISO 9001:2015 are included in the process. Now, where this comes up occasionally is we will see that an organization has brought in a consultant to do their internal audit, and then nobody has gone back and audited the audit. Bear in mind, the internal audit requirements, that's part of the standard. So you can certainly bring a consultant in to do the audit, but that's going to mean that someone else has to look at the consultant's work to ensure that the internal audit process itself has been included. Now, the other item on that first clause that I like to point out is that the audit is expected to be done against the quality management system. And this is key because ISO 9001 itself establishes that a quality management system is made up of processes. If you look in ISO 9001:2015, section 441, in the second paragraph, it states that you will determine the processes needed for the quality management system and their application throughout the organization. So accordingly, the organization is expected to structure their internal audits with respect to the processes and not the clauses. So the days of filling out an elemental checklist, those days are not over per se, but you do need to be prepared to explain and demonstrate how your internal audit process was structured in such a way that it was an audit of your processes. Now from there, the requirement continues and states that you need to implement an audit program that gets into frequency and methods. You need to define the audit criteria and your scope for each audit. So what requirements, what areas are you going to look at? You need to select auditors and conduct audits in such a way that it ensures objectivity and impartiality. That's a key point. That the results of the audit are reported. Another key point, that you take appropriate correction and corrective action without delay, and that you retain documented information of the implementation of the audit program. So let's pick apart these key points here. First of all, we get into this with auditor competency. You'll note that the standard says really very little in terms of what's expected for auditor competency. Competency of the auditor in this context is viewed in the same way as competency in any other part of the company, in any other aspect of what you do. So in other words, if you have a particular method that you've determined is effective for making an auditor competent, great. We will get behind that and we will review the audit itself and see if in fact your auditors were competent in doing the audit. Now, this needs to be more than just a training sign-off. There needs to be an actual process in play. You are required to determine competency requirements, not just for auditors, but for everyone else in Section 7.2 of the ISO 9001 standard. Now, another item that we see a lot in the nonconformances that PGR writes is a lack of responsiveness to internal audit nonconformances. Now, when you have an internal audit and your auditors are issuing nonconformances, those need to be treated with the same degree of seriousness that you treat nonconformances from PJR or from customer complaints. And you'll note that the requirement specifically mentions both correction and corrective action in this context. So not just putting out the fire per se, but also taking action to prevent recurrence of the issue, digging down to the cause. Now, obviously, this is another records intensive requirement. You have to have evidence that the internal audit process is being executed. And this means not just the nonconformances, but also the evidence that the audit was done. So whether that's internal audit checklists or raw auditor notes or a combination therein paired with an audit report, etc., whatever is going to ultimately work for you is fine, but understand that a pile of nonconformances by themselves do not constitute a record of an internal audit. Because unless the auditor wrote a nonconformance for every single thing they saw during the audit, there are going to be things that were looked at that are not on the record. So do bear that in mind when you're planning out your internal audit process. Now, I've alluded to this already. Many of our clients choose to outsource their internal audits to a consultant, and that's perfectly fine. But you need to recognize that regardless of who's actually doing the audit, the responsibility for the audit program, scheduling the audit, maintaining the audit records, responding to the nonconformances and so forth, that is your responsibility as the stewards of the organization and not your consultant's responsibility. You should, as an organization, be able to speak confidently about how your internal audit process is controlled and how you are involved in making it effective. Let's move on to the fourth most often cited item, and that is quality objectives. Quality objectives, in the standard, there's two specific sections that are included. The first talks about establishing quality objectives at relevant functions and levels, and that they need to be consistent with your quality policy. They need to be measurable. They need to be built on applicable requirements. They need to be relevant to conformity of products and services and enhancement of customer satisfaction. And they need to be monitored, communicated, and updated as appropriate. So let's dig into some of this verbiage here. And let's begin with this idea that objectives need to be measurable. Now, the idea behind this is that if the objectives are not measurable, there's really no way for us to determine if the objective was met or not. Now, obviously, there's a couple of ways that you can approach this. Most organizations choose to have what you can refer to as a variable measurement type objective. So, for example, to say that you're going to have 97% on-time delivery, or that you're going to have 2% or less scrap within a month. That's something that you can measure, and there's going to be a particular number associated with it. Now, again, those are the most common types of objectives, but attribute type objectives are also considered acceptable. So what's an attribute type objective? Well, that could be, for example, to say that you are going to have a new certification, say to NADCAP, by the end of the year. Well, that's something that you either accomplish or you don't accomplish. It's kind of a pass-fail type item. That's what we refer to as attribute type objectives. And again, they're both considered acceptable. Now, this business about relevancy to customer satisfaction and products or services, that was new verbiage when the 9001:2015 standard was published. Now, it's important to note that objectives that are rooted in other areas, You know, we see these from time to time where an organization wants to have an objective for profitability, for safety, these kinds of things. Those are perfectly fine, but they do not necessarily get to this business of relevancy to customer satisfaction or products and services. So if you're going to have an objective for something like profitability or safety or so forth, you need to have sufficient additional objectives that meet this requirement. Now, another thing I always like to share is that quality objectives are, this is a topic that basically anyone in the quality management system can be asked about. Everyone from the president all the way down to the entry-level employees. Very much like the quality policy, the expectation is that we should be able to ask you about these items, and you should be able to demonstrate some very basic awareness and knowledge of the item. Now, how you accomplish that as an organization is entirely up to you. A lot of companies, they have placards, they have cards that they hand out, they may have monthly meetings. All of these things are fine. None of these things are mandatory. So you're simply going to have to choose what works for you. The last part of the quality objectives requirement states that when you're planning to achieve the objectives, you need to determine what will be done, and what the resources are going to be, who's going to be responsible, when it will be done, and how you will evaluate the results. Now, we can turn to 9002 for a little bit of clarity on this business of what will be done. And the explanation that's given is that the organization needs to determine the actions that need to be implemented to achieve its quality objectives. You know, what are the actions that you're going to take to make this happen? Now, the key overall takeaway from part two of the requirement is that it's not enough to simply have the objectives established. You have to track progress achieved towards the objectives. And if you are underperforming in those objectives, you need to take necessary action to improve objectives performance. So necessary action means an appropriate response. That doesn't necessarily mean corrective action. But you cannot just sit back and say, oh, well, if an objective is not met. There needs to be action that you're taking. There needs to be a response. Our fourth item in our study was related to monitoring and measuring resources. Now, I suspect a lot of our folks on the presentation today, you probably still refer to this requirement as calibration. And I confess, I do this a lot as well. Monitoring and measuring resources, this is meant to be an inclusive term, and it essentially refers to any device or tool or gauge or meter or scale or anything else that you're using to perform monitoring and measurement of your outputs. Now, most typically, this is referred to as inspection or testing. Now, the clause that's in play here from ISO 9001 is section 715, and 715 has two subclauses. Now, the first of these talks about that you need to determine what your resources are going to be to provide valid and reliable measurement results. You need to make sure that these things are suitable for the types of monitoring and measuring activities that you're doing, and that you need to retain appropriate documented information of fitness for use for purpose of the monitoring and measurement resources. Now, that last bit is the one that's emphasized. And again, it's a retained documented information requirement. So for most organizations, this is going to manifest in the calibration / verification records for all measurement devices. You have to have records of these items. Now, in terms of what's in the records, this is going to be most typically influenced by the second part of the requirement. So let's jump ahead to that part right now. Okay, So lots of key things going on here. So measuring equipment is supposed to be calibrated or verified or both at specified intervals against measurement standards traceable to international or national measurement standards. That's a key point. Measurement devices also need to be identified in order to determine their status and then safeguarded from any kind of adjustments, damage, or deterioration. And then if there's been damage or deterioration, you're supposed to take steps to make sure any product affected has been properly controlled. Now, from those items that we just looked at, there's two areas where we see the most issues. The first is this business of traceability to national or international standards. Now, here in the United States, this is done primarily through the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So how do we approach this? Well, if I have a device from your shop floor and I say, okay, let me see some proof that this has been calibrated or verified in such a way that it's traceable to a national standard, where am I looking for that? I'm looking on your certificates. I'm looking within your records. I need to see that linkage to a national measurement standard. Now, in certain situations, they're rare, there are circumstances where there is no NIST traceable method for the calibration. Now, this is usually associated with a piece of highly specialized inspection equipment, something that was built for a company specifically to inspect a particular aspect of a product. Now, where that is the case, typically, it's considered acceptable for the calibration to be provided by the device manufacturer. Now, the other item that is most often cited in this area is consistent and reliable device identification. So, a couple of things about this. First of all, this is not exclusively calibration stickers. We still run into this from time to time where organizations are under the mistaken impression that we're talking exclusively about calibration stickers. There's a lot of ways that you can identify a device. Again, you'll note the verbiage that's used here. Identification in order to determine status. So as long as you've got some type of device identification that gets me back to the calibration records, it's going to typically be considered acceptable. So again, not exclusively calibration stickers. Our last item is external provider approvals. Now, in the older versions of ISO 9001, we had some different terminology that was used. These were referred to as suppliers, in some cases, subcontractors, if you go way back, outside partners. And the requirements pertaining to interface with these folks, in some cases, resided in different parts of the standard. Now, in the 2015 version, all of these terms were merged under the common heading external provider. However, the requirements to approve these parties are not new. These are not new requirements, and these can be found in the third paragraph of section 8.4.1. Here's the critical verbiage here. You need to determine and apply criteria for the evaluation, selection, monitoring of performance, and reevaluation of external providers based on their ability to provide processes, products, or services in accordance with requirements. And you need to retain documented information of these activities and any necessary actions arising from the evaluations. Okay, so first of all, it's up to you how you're going to evaluate your external providers. And there's lots of ways to do it. And there's even allowances for there being different methods. You know, if as an organization, it makes sense for you to evaluate raw material suppliers using one set of requirements, and testing laboratories using an entirely different set of steps, fine. But you need to be on top of things in terms of what your evaluation method is going to be. And you'll note that it does call for both monitoring and reevaluation. So it's not enough to just say they're approved and forget about them. There does need to be an ongoing evaluation. Also, you'll note the verbiage that's used. It states retain documented information of these evaluation activities needs to be on the record. And that's key. In other words, having the external provider's name on a list is not enough because this isn't evidence of the evaluation, and it doesn't constitute a record of the evaluation activity. So that's why the verbiage is so critical in how it's written into the standard. So moving into two other key areas from the 2015 standard, and these were the two really new requirements that stood out in our analysis, and that's risk and interested parties. So let's start with risk. The term risk is actually used 16 times in the auditable portion of the ISO 9001 standard. And the idea is that risk is a system-wide strategy, very much in the same way that continual improvement is a system-wide strategy. And that goes all the way back to the 2000 version of the standard. Now, it's important to emphasize that a formal risk management process is not specifically required. The idea is that risk aversion is something that impacts the entire quality management system. ISO 9002 talks about key risks, and it says, you know, these might include the failure of your processes, products, or services to meet requirements, or overall not achieving customer satisfaction. So the actual verbiage from the standard for risk comes from Section 6.1, and it talks about the organization needing to consider the issues in 4.1. These are things that come from both inside and outside the organization, and the requirements referred to in 4.2. Now that means these are items that come from both internal and external interested parties. And then determine the risks and opportunities that need to be addressed to give assurance that your management system can achieve its intended results as well as improvement. And then also, and here's where we have kind of the two-part view on this, that you're going to enhance desirable effects and reduce undesired effects. So this is why that last bit under 6.1.1 before we hit letter A, it talks about risks and opportunities. This is being cognizant of both. That's kind of the big picture here. Now, 6.1.2 of the standard goes on to say that you need to plan then your actions to address risks and opportunities and how you're going to implement and integrate those actions into your processes. So, what do they mean by actions to address risks and opportunities? Well, again, we can turn to 9002 for some further guidance in this area. And 9002 breaks down the actions taken into five general categories. These include risk avoidance, just stop doing the process in question altogether, risk limitation, having procedures or work instructions to assist your team and try to then reduce the risk in question, sharing of risk, expanding. Working with your customers, perhaps to agree on if raw material availability is the risk, maybe they'll agree to bulk purchases. Transferring of risk, this could be things like having insurance and so forth. And then finally, risk acceptance. Once you've taken all of the reasonable measures, accepting that the remaining risk that is left over is acceptable to the team. So, how is PJR auditing this requirement? Well, we've trained our auditors to ask about risk management and to be prepared to examine what is presented by the auditee. Again, we understand that this is open to interpretation. That's been a theme of our presentation today. Understand that there's really only one requirement within ISO 9001 that gets into records pertaining to risk actions, and that's tied to management review. We actually looked at this a little bit earlier, where it said that your management review needs to include discussion on the effectiveness of action taken to address risks and opportunities. And obviously, management review is required to be on the record. So understand that your discussion with the auditor on this point is going to be a dialogue. They're going to want to feel confident that you know what you're talking about and you know what has been deployed for your organization on the topic of risk. Let's move on to interested parties. For this, we should begin with the definition of interested party, which is taken from Annex A of the standard. This is a person or organization that can affect, be affected by, or perceive themselves to be affected by a decision or activity. Now, the obvious thing here to begin with is, who are the interested parties? Well, there's a lot of potential for who could be. Some obvious, some not so obvious. In a couple of slides here, we're going to take a look at a long list of possibles that's given in ISO 9002. Now, Clause 4.2 of ISO 9001 requires that as an organization, you determine who your interested parties are, but it is emphasized that they need to be relevant to the quality management system. So it's up to you to determine what that means. The term is just intended to broaden the scope of who such requirements might be coming from. Obviously, ensuring that you're cognizant of applicable requirements, this is simply good business. Now, one point that we do want to make here, and that is that it is most likely inappropriate to conclude that the only interested party group is your customers. We've trained our auditors that if an organization says customers only, to challenge that conclusion and to ask, okay, well, what was the process that you followed to conclude that the customers were the only interested party that was relevant? And furthermore, if no evidence of a structured analysis can be provided, it's most likely that the process that they that was used to select the interested parties was flawed, and potentially a nonconformance should be issued. So here's that list of potentials in terms of who the possible interested parties are going to be. And as you can see here, there's lots of possibilities. Yes, customers, but also folks like owners, shareholders, unions, external providers, the employees within the organization and working on behalf of the organization, neighboring organizations, competitors, and so forth. So how do you figure out what the interested parties want? Well, again, we can turn to 9002 for some guidance on what the possible approaches might be. And I suspect most of you on our call today are already doing most, if not all, of these types of activities. So we could be reviewing the orders that we're receiving. We could have oversight on statutory and regulatory requirements from perhaps from a legal department. We could be doing lobbying or networking, could be doing market surveillance, could be doing customer or user surveys, could be doing supplier surveys even. Lots of ways to get this information. Now, is it possible that you could have nonconformances relating to interested parties? It is possible. There's actually going to be two circumstances where a nonconformance is likely appropriate. First of all, if there is no evidence or limited evidence of an implemented process for monitoring and reviewing information, that would represent a violation of ISO 9001 Section 4.2. Also, if there's no evidence that interested party feedback is being discussed within management review, that would represent a violation of ISO 9001 Section 932C1. Now, not to sound like Columbo here, but there's one more thing that I'd like to go over. And that is section 5.1 as it pertains to leadership. Now, leadership was, at least in this context, it was a new idea when the 2015 version of the standard was published. And we chose to approach this head on. And we wrote some targeted questions into our audit report under the heading Leadership Interview. And we told our auditors to be cognizant of this in reviewing the quality system. Make sure that management's fingerprints are on the quality management system. So here are the questions taken directly from our report. You know, what are you doing to make yourself accountable for the effectiveness of the system? How do you participate in the system? Who are your interested parties? Do you have a process for monitoring the requirements of your interested parties? And what are some of the current internal and external issues that you're attempting to deal with? These are all taken from sections 4 and 5 of the standard, and it's intended to give management a chance to demonstrate that they're on top of these things, that they are involved in the quality management system. Now, in some cases, when we get the report back from the auditor, we'll look at the leadership interview and we will see that only one person was included. And I want to tell you that that's going to be conceivable in a small organization, but the bigger the organization gets, the less likely this is an appropriate thing to do. Leadership for most companies of any given size is going to mean multiple persons. So bear that in mind. When the auditor wants to talk to the leadership team, they do mean a team, not just the president, not just the CEO, but the team. 9002 has also got some thoughts on leadership, and it does state that although things can be delegated, the accountability remains with top management. Perhaps some of you on the call remember the days when we had a person that was referred to as the management representative, and that was the person that kind of ran the show as far as ISO 9001 was concerned. That still is possible to have an MR, but you definitely have to be prepared to demonstrate that you, the management team, the leadership team, are involved in the quality management system. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation that there are obviously going to be circumstances and possibilities where auditor and auditee don't agree with each other. As an accredited certification body, we're required to provide a process for an impartial review of contested nonconformances. Now, our process is explained in a procedure called Pro 10. Now, if you want to get your hands on Pro 10, it's actually available for download on our website. If you go to pgr.com, go to the bottom of the page and look for registration document download, that's where you can get your hands on it. Now, it's important to point out that any dispute needs to be filed within 15 days, that's calendar days, of the end of the audit. Now, we will work with that deadline under extenuating circumstances, but most of the time, if you have been given your report at the end of the audit, and in most cases, that's definitely what happens, the clock is ticking in terms of filing a dispute. So in conclusion, the 9001 2015 standard is still the world's most utilized management system standard. There are just over 880,000 worldwide registered companies. Many of the items that are cited in nonconformances really are entirely avoidable, and they seem to come up again and again. I do hope that the content of our presentation today is going to leave you feeling more confident that things are going to go well for you on audit day. Now, if you're ready for a deeper dive, we do have a clause-by-clause primer course. For anyone that is new to ISO 9001 2015 and needs to have a better understanding in preparation for an audit. Now, the title of this course is ISO 9001 2015, a clause-by-clause analysis, and it is free. And if you look on our website, you'll find the link for it. I'd like to invite you to tune in to one of our other webinars, two that I want to highlight today. We have one on non-applicable clauses and what can be and what cannot be exempted in an audit assessment. It's going to go over the right way to approach those areas. We also have a presentation, a well-received presentation on the interaction of processes and its importance to a successful audit. And then obviously a variety of webinars on other topics, stage one auditing, corrective action, numerous other standards. If you'd like to be kept informed of the latest news automatically, the best way for you to do that is to opt in. And to opt in, you would simply visit our website at www.pjr.com, go to the bottom of the page, input your email address in the provided space, and click subscribe. You'll be opted in for updates of points of interest, upcoming webinars, and other relevant news. I do thank you for your time today. At this time, I'm going to go ahead and unlock the dashboard for the questions. We'll see what we have for questions today. Dr. Ayman Eshra has two questions. His first question is the difference between verification and validation. Generally, Dr. Eshra, the verification is typically understood as proof on paper, in other words, a review of outputs against inputs with a confirmation that the outputs have addressed all input requirements. Validation is typically understood as proof in practice, and this is typically going to be, does the item work as intended? Dr. Eshra's other question, competency has four skills. Is there a checklist for competency? No checklist that is mandatory. Competency can be recorded in any manner that really that works for you. It just needs to account for all of the competency requirements that you've established. Derek Hashbrook asks, are these issues common in AS9100? Well, Derek, I think I can say that yes, these issues definitely do come up in AS9100, but obviously AS9100, there's going to be other areas that are going to potentially come up, perhaps at more frequency. I'm not certain. If you want to inquire about that, I'm certain that one of either your auditor or one of our AS9100 executive committee members could probably give you some input on that. Appreciate the compliments from Scott Nagami, Tom Stimple, and John Nagel. You're quite welcome. Glad you enjoyed today's presentation. Are there any other questions today? Okay, have a great day, everyone, and take care.